As summer comes to a close, insects and arachnids have some important work to get done, and some of that work makes them easier to see. This hour, ants, dragonflies, and spiders. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be here. We'll talk about slave maker ant raiding parties, dragonfly swarms, and the beautiful work of orb weaver spiders. ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here, and he and Donald will answer your questions. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and summer is almost over. That means a lot of things, of course, but it also means that insects and arachnids have some important work to get done before winter comes, and some of that work makes them very visible. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here to help us understand what we're seeing out there. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Happy to be here.
Now, of course, a lot of kids spend a lot of time sitting on the sidewalk or somewhere else and watching ants. This time of year, even adults kind of get into the act because there's some unusual things going on. So let's talk about yellow ants and what they're doing right now.
Well, especially one species called the larger yellow ant releases their swarmers out into the environment at this time of the year. Just to back up a step, all ant species, whether they're carpenter ants or grease ants or these soil ants, have the ability to send off emissaries when everything is right, when the colony is healthy, when they can afford to send off reproductives on the very, very slim chance that they're going to be able to reproduce. But it is part of the perpetuation of the species for ant colonies to send off kings and queens, males and females, what we call swarmers, on the chance that they will get off, they will go off and start a new colony somewhere else. We see this occasionally. We see winged ants in the springtime when we see some carpenter ants emerging from hollow trees and so forth. But in the fall of the year, as the sun is going down in the evening, sometimes the air is just full of these shimmering wings of the swarmers of the larger yellow ant. It's a little later than usual this year, but it has been spectacular.
So I can imagine a lot of people see this and have no idea what they're looking at.
Exactly. And other people see it and shrug their shoulders and go on with their lives.
And probably some freak out a little.
I don't know how they do that. And yes, others will say, oh my gosh, we're being invaded by something. Swarmer ants are always harmless to us, whether they're in your house having emerged from under the cupboards, or if they're in your yard emerging from the soil, or they're in your hollow tree emerging from the decayed wood inside. Swarmers are always harmless. They are not the problem. Oftentimes when we talk about ant problems, we're talking about the workers, because they're the ones that are digging out the wood. They're the ones that are gathering the food. They're the ones out foraging on your kitchen counter, hoping you left a peach pie out overnight. They're the ones that cause problems for us. These swarmers, these adults with wings, are harmless to us, but it's the colony's way of saying, we're going to take this chance, send a bunch of our members out, hoping they can reproduce.
All right. Now, these swarmers, when they come out, we'll talk in a little while about dragonfly swarms, and this is a related topic. But when these swarmers come out, a lot of them get eaten. Do we have any idea what the success rate is of these ants when they go out into the world?
I don't have any data to tell you that it's 90% or is it 99%, but there's a really, really high failure rate. Either they're going to die of desiccation, they're going to get eaten, they're going to get stepped on, they're going to get splatted onto your windshield. There's lots of ways for them to die. And it's in the category of nothing ventured, nothing gained, that the ant species is going to continue to be there because the colony they came from is still in the ground or still in the hollow tree. But these are extras to the colony that were sent off on very slim chances. And my guess is it's about a 99% failure rate.
It's a death or glory kind of mission, right?
You get one or the other. You get to mate and reproduce and start a new colony, or you get eaten by a bird or a dragonfly, or you just die of desiccation. But it's a process that all ant species go through. We know some other social insects that do this as well. But even if they make it to the next step, even if they find a mate, even if they're mated, they still have to find a place to start a colony. And this is going to be a single queen now working by herself, starting from scratch, building a colony where none has been before. So it's fraught with failure.
Well, it really makes it seem all the more remarkable that there are so many ants.
Well, that is part of the solution. If there's a high failure rate, you send thousands out on the slim chance that one will make it, one or two. You need one male, one female. So the fact that 99% of them didn't make it was okay because the little 1% did. And we see that a lot. We see that with when insects lay their eggs. A female will lay 200 or 1,000 eggs, knowing that most of them won't make it. There'll be this really high failure rate, but enough will to perpetuate the species. And this is one strategy, overwhelmed with numbers on the chance that a few will make it.
You know, we think about insects getting ready for the winter. We have, of course, the old tale of the ant and the grasshopper. So the ants are preparing for the winter in a studious and, they're good workers. We know that about ants, right?
Hardworking.
So these swarms that go out, if they do find a mate and they're sort of tasked with building a colony all on their own, how do they make it through the winter?
They will hibernate. They are equipped, at least the females are equipped with the ability to withstand below freezing temperatures. Now, they're going to get into a protected location because they're emerging from the safety of the colony so late in the season. Their job is to mate and get into a protected location under the loose bark of trees, maybe crawl into your basement window well, maybe even crawl into the hollow spaces of your foundation. But they will survive through the winter, some of them will, and start the colony next spring. So in this case, these queens are the ones that are going to have the ability to make it through the winter with a body that contains a little bit of a chemical that's similar to antifreeze that allows them to withstand the freezing temperatures.
All right, before we move on from ants, I want to talk about another phenomenon, and that is slave maker ant raiding parties. What are you talking about?
This is just such a crazy story. It's hard to believe that it's really true. It almost sounds like someone made this up. But every once in a while, someone will comment that they saw a line of reddish-colored ants going back and forth across their driveway. And when they went one direction, they had nothing. But when they went the other direction, they were carrying these little white sacks, which are the pupae of field ants. And the slave makers are the reddish-colored ants, and they have gone on a raiding party and overtaken a underground colony of what we call the field ants, the ones that build the mounds in your yard, and they are stealing their babies. And when those pupae, the baby, the immature stage, when they get back into the slave maker colony, they will emerge and they will start working for the other species. So when you can't raise enough of your own offspring to keep things going, this ant has solved that problem by having this ability to raid and steal the babies of another colony and make them their own.
That's horrible.
Well, it seems to work for this one species. And the thing that people notice are these raiding parties. There'll be this long line of ants trudging along in a straight line over to the field ant nest, disappearing underground, coming back up carrying a little white pupa and taking it home. And those raiding parties become noticeable to people. Could be any time of the summer, but kind of in the second half of the summer. So it's an interesting ant that has evolved a special relationship with its neighbors, and that is to use the neighbors for your own purposes.
All right, let's move on from ants, although I have a suspicion we could talk about ants all day. Something else that people see this time of year often, and as a result, some time of these swarmer ants that we were talking about, are dragonfly swarms. And they have been so visible in the last couple of weeks. People get pretty excited when they see hundreds, maybe even thousands of dragonflies all gathered together. What's going on with that?
It's a spectacle. It's a special moment that dragonflies will form these swarms where there is a food source available. And most people are familiar with dragonflies, the cellophane wings, the long, slender body. And you'll see these dragonflies zigzagging back and forth through the air. And where there's a food source available, hundreds will accumulate, usually in twilight, just sort of at the end of the day, just before sundown. And what they're doing is they're flying back and forth. They are zigzagging and scooping some sort of flying insect out of the air with their front legs that are held like a basket under their mouth, and they pop the flying insect into their mouth, and that's how they're feeding. It could be mosquitoes that they're feeding on at that time of the night, could be some other flying gnats or something. But in the times I have seen this and the reports that I've had, often it's these ant swarmers that are emerging from the ground with hopes of glory, of mating and finding a new colony, only to be snatched from the air and swallowed down the gullet of a dragonfly flying by.
Well, it is a lot of fun to watch. And we put up a video that was provided by Tom Hillier of West Liberty of a dragonfly swarm. That's up on our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio. And we're nearly out of time for this segment of the show, although, of course, you can join us with your questions about any of these topics. But something else that has been highly visible this time of year, and I thought it was just me until I talked to you yesterday, Donald, and that is so many spiders, so many orb weaver spiders making those beautiful sort of quintessential spider webs all over the place. Are there more of them this year than usual?
We don't have a census to document this with any data, but the number of inquiries that we're getting here in Extension Entomology and in our local county extension offices would indicate that people are seeing more, or they're asking more questions, because the volume of calls and email inquiries is way up over previous years. I don't have a good explanation for that. We always see more spiders in the fall of the year because they have reproduced and grown during the winter, so we see them more in the fall of the year. On the dewy mornings, we see those concentric circle webs strung between the plants. So they show up in the fall of the year, but the number of inquiries is way up. And, of course, when we're talking about these orb weaver spiders, we're talking about more than 100 different kinds here in North America. Most people are familiar with the really big black and yellow one, really vibrant colors. That one we call the black and yellow garden spider. But there are three or four others that are also out there, some of them quite variable in color. One of my favorite is called the marbled orb weaver. It's got these beautiful orange patches on it. So lots of different orb weaver spiders, not just the one. And yes, more of them this year than normal, it seems.
All right. And would they be, there are more of them, would they also be more active this time of year? Would they be spinning more webs?
Well, this is their time of the year to get in that last gasp of food. They have to catch some prey in order to lay those egg sacs that will wait and hatch next spring. So eat now, reproduce, and die in the winter.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis, ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will also join us shortly, and you can join us with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa. With me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron is also here now. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here today. And, of course, you can join the conversation with your questions about plants or insects or arachnids. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll start off with a couple of email questions here. This one is from Christopher. He says, I have a hyacinth bean plant whose leaves started curling on new growth and never recovered. Do you know what would cause that?
Curling. Okay. I guess one possibility would be herbicide drift of some type. That would cause usually twisting and maybe some distortion of the actual leaf. And if that were the case, I would also expect to see that on other plants in the same general area. So okay. That would kind of confirm it.
aphids on the undersides of the leaves could cause curling, but that's not a common problem on beans, so I wouldn't expect to find them. But look on the insides of the curls, look on the undersides of the leaves for aphids. But we're at the end of the season, and control probably won't be practical anymore this year.
Right. So just feel frustrated and move on to next year, perhaps, at this point.
It'll be a better year next
year. Right. It always, always will be.
We are Cubs fans. It will be better next year.
All right. This one's from Tony. We received a diagnosis from the ISU Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic just yesterday. Apparently, we have signs of spruce bud scale and spider mites. Our tree is around 65 years old. It's very tall and a bit too remote to use a hose to apply insecticide on higher branches. The higher branches appear to be infested as well. Are there ground or soil treatment methods for both issues? If so, when should that be done?
This is one of those issues that we really don't have good answers for, because the bud scale that's on spruce is not going to react as it's not going to be as effectively controlled by our soil applied systemics. And soil applied systemics on conifers are usually not our first choice. This is one where we kind of hope in another year that the biological controls will take over, and that's usually what holds us in check. Most of us never have this problem because we always have a few. Because we don't have a problem, we have a few, but we don't have the many. And we don't have the many because we have biological controls out there. So I think this is one where we wait for next year. We see what happens when things come out, and be ready with a contact insecticide if we need it. But using insecticides for scale often causes spider mite problems. So we hope the better weather, better biological controls next year keep us from having this problem repeat.
All right. Here's another question. This one's from Tyler. We planted a Japanese tree lilac in mid-June. We started to lose leaves about a month ago, and it has about a quarter of the leaves left on it. The leaves also have small brown spots on them. Could this possibly be a disease or a lack of water? Will the tree come back next year?
Well, there may be a foliar disease there, too, but also maybe planting stress. So at this point, I guess the key would be not to panic. We've had plenty of moisture to this point. If we have a dry, let's say, late September, October, November, go ahead and water. Water periodically until the ground freezes. And hopefully, also rake up the leaves that fall, just in case it is a foliar disease. Rake those up, remove them, and destroy them.
All right. Let's go to the phones, and you're welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Jan is up next in Adair. Hi, Jan.
Hi, good morning. I have not seen any monarchs for a couple of weeks, and I let milkweeds grow in my flower bed. But I'd really like to cut down the milkweeds, but I don't want to get rid of them until the monarchs have gone.
Why don't we give them till the end of the month? This is one of those issues where we don't have a hard and fast rule. But when we look back through the historical records, most of our monarchs fly out of Iowa. They've flown down from Canada, Minnesota, and so forth. They're flying through Iowa about September 6th through 12th. So the migration should have already started, which means now is not when they're going to be laying eggs, but now is when the last of the larvae could still have a chance to grow, develop, and get out of here before it freezes.
Now, I could cut off the pods, though.
Sure. The pods aren't going to help the monarchs at all. Neither the caterpillars nor the butterflies use the pods for anything.
Okay, well, the pods carry the seeds, and, you know, I mean, I like a few of them, but I don't want...
But you don't want all of them. Yeah.
No.
We understand. No, cleaning up the pods would be a good idea now. But, of course, all you have to do is get them done before the pods split open.
Yeah, well, I have a few that are thinking about it. So.
Now's the time.
All right, well, and Jan, so many people want to plant milkweed now. You might have some takers for those pods, too.
I'd be glad to give away seeds. Just give me a call.
All right.
Thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Tim is on the line next in Iowa City. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm interested in spider economics. if a spider spins a web, well, when a spider spins a web across my front door, and I go out of the front door and ruin the web completely, does the spider have the resources to make another web, or have I ruined him forever?
More likely her, not him.
Yes, I beg your pardon.
Yes. This doesn't offend me, but you might want to be careful how you talk to her. The spiders recycle silk. They will leave it out overnight if it's a night-dwelling spider, or they'll leave it out during the day. But as it gets dusty, as it gets wet, it loses its effectiveness. So they will ingest it and recycle the protein that they have spun out of the spinnerets on their tail end and stretched into the silk. I don't think losing silk once or twice or a few times is going to bankrupt the energy reserves of the spider, but she does need that. She does need the recycling of that raw material to keep going. But we're reaching the end of their time in this generation. So as we get closer and closer to fall, which for most of these large spiders means closer and closer to death, that becomes less of an issue.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. You've been absolved from a lot of guilt there, Tim.
And we have a new term to use, spider economics.
All right. 866-780-9100 is the number to call with your question. This one's from Tom. He says, I would like to talk about growing pineapple for a houseplant. I grew one years ago, but I had a friend hand carry a fresh pineapple home from vacation. My question is, do I need a fresh one or can I just go to a store and get one that has been gassed?
Well, you can take the top from pineapple. And what you want to do is simply make a cut around the base of that foliage, going down to the fruit about an inch or so. And then once you've done that, then just leave it on the counter for a few days to kind of callus over. And then get a pot and a very well-drained potting soil. So you may want to add some coarse sand or some perlite to the existing potting soil that you have. And then stick it in that, and there's a good chance it's going to root and start to grow.
Even with a store-bought pineapple?
Yes, yes.
Yep, they're not. They're still a living, growing plant. And, of course, I think pineapples take 18 months to mature in the tropics.
Yes, a long time.
And it's going to be a long time till you're harvesting pineapple out of your windowsill.
Yes.
Is that even possible? Could that be the reward for growing one?
It's possible, but most likely not. Typically, it has to be a certain age before it can do that. And then you have to kind of help it, where you kind of put it in a plastic bag and maybe put an apple in there to encourage it.
Okay. This is all good information. I'm taking notes.
That's right. All right, and let us know how your pineapple crop turns out.
Yeah, you're listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me today, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and ISU Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Carmen is on the line next in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Carmen.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, I had a cucumber magnolia tree I bought and had planted this June by a reputable nursery here in Cedar Rapids. They planted it for me, and it had leaves. I watered it, and 2, 3, 4 weeks later, no leaves, bare. I called the nursery, and they asked if I watered it. Of course, I watered it. I've waited for this tree for the longest time. And they asked me to pinch or see if the tree was dead and break the little
twigs
branch. Yeah, to see if it was dead. Mm-hmm. Some of them were dead. It was breakable, but some of them were still bendable. And I want, they're going to try and get me another tree for next year, but I want to know, what should I do so it doesn't happen again?
Well, there's not much you can do. Basically, you hope that they give you a good, healthy tree, that they plant it correctly, and that you give it good care. And typically when those things happen, the vast majority of trees will survive. But every once in a while, for some reason, they don't. And maybe it wasn't as healthy as it looked, or something else wasn't quite right and it didn't survive. But usually when you have a healthy plant, you plant it correctly, give it good care, the vast majority of plants will survive. But every once in a while, unfortunately, you lose one. So,
and when they planted it, I didn't want to be where the guys were because I didn't want to be pushy. But I wanted to make sure that they were planting it correctly. Supposedly they followed the instructions, but should I just be pushy next time?
Well, I think you can watch. Basically, when they plant the tree, the top of the root ball should be maybe a few inches, maybe 2 or 3 inches above the surrounding terrain, so just a little bit high, okay?
Okay.
And as far as watering, basically, if they plant it in the spring, you're going to want to water that tree probably every day for maybe 4 or 5 days. And when you do water, for example, water the root ball directly, because that's where most of the roots are initially. So water that root ball directly, and also the area just beyond the root ball. And so water every day for probably 4 or 5 days, and then begin to water less frequently. So you may water after the 4th day, 5th day, and then skip a day, and then water. Maybe skip 2 days and then water. And after about a month or so, once a week should be fine if it's not raining. If it's raining, we get a good inch of rain, it's fine. But after a month, once a week should be fine in most cases.
All right, Carmen, thanks so much for your call and good luck. I hope next year goes better. Next, we'll talk to Valerie in Ames. Hi, Valerie.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Yeah. My question is, I saw little clusters of brown leaves at the end of the branches on oak trees. I saw them on the Iowa State campus, mm-hmm. and I've seen them in my neighborhood in mm-hmm. Ames. And I've never noticed that before, but they're sort of sparsely distributed, but definitely real regularly distributed around the whole canopy of the tree.
Right.
I didn't know what that was, and is that a problem?
Well, it's also on my pin oak in my front yard. That's caused by a little canker in most cases, which is a fungal disease, and it basically girdles that little branch or twig, and as a result, then that little branch or twig dies. It turns brown. It's very, very common, typically in late summer, and apparently for this year, the weather conditions were just right, and it's very common. You see it on campus here in Ames, in the city of Ames itself. It's very, very common on certain oaks.
Red oaks especially, more so mm-hmm. than maybe the white oaks. But it's not an insect problem when the clusters stay in the tree. Every once in a while, clusters will drop to the ground, and that could be an insect problem or squirrel damage. But this is very distinctive, that the outer 4 to 5 leaves on a twig turn brown, and then they stay there on the tree.
And a canker is a fungus, but you really can't control it with fungicides. So, but the good news is this is a fairly common occurrence, and it doesn't seem to have any long-term effect on the trees.
All right. Valerie, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Jim in Moline, Illinois. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I have butterfly weed, Asclepias tuberosa, that I was hoping to harvest the seed pods.
Okay.
And just as they begin to mature, something's been eating the pods, and I was kind of curious what would do that.
Eating them as in chewing them up or eating them as in sucking the sap?
It seems like they're actually gnawing a hole in them. It's not like they're eating the whole pod. They're gnawing a hole and then taking the eating the seeds out from it. Just as they're maturing. It kind of reminded me of watching these caterpillars that they see eating gentians in a way, the gentian pods.
Yes, and I don't have an exact answer for that, so we made it into the 36th minute of the show before we got stumped this time. That makes me feel pretty good. There are cutworms that could crawl up and do that. But this late in the year, we don't have a lot of other critters to blame. So I'm going to stick with cutworms until we find an actual critter. Now, to find who's doing it, I suspect you would have better luck looking at night. So take your flashlight or your miner's helmet out and watch at night to see if we can figure out who's doing this and get us a good picture, and we'll give you a better answer than the guess I was able to come up with this morning.
All right, but it's probably a lost cause for this year. If it is cutworms and he has butterfly weed in the same place next year, is this going to be a recurrent problem?
You know, this is Jim's the first one who's ever asked me this question, so I don't have a background on this one to say, oh, yes, this will happen every once in a while or this will happen always. My guess is this is a rare occurrence rather than a common occurrence. So we're going to learn a whole lot more about milkweeds than we ever did before because a lot more people are planting them, a lot more people are paying attention to them. We're going to find these things that we never thought to look for before. So as we go forward from now, we'll have a better answer. But if we could get, if we could catch the critter in action, that would be a much better answer than what I have now.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for your call. And on the same subject, Jan emailed, I let the milkweeds grow in the garden and I watched them all summer. We've had 3 or 4 black and yellow monarch caterpillars over the summer. They're large when they suddenly appear on the milkweeds, like an inch and a half, and then they suddenly disappear. Have they crawled off or are birds or predator bugs getting them?
Yes, could be any of those. Could be crawled off, could be finished their development. Monarchs start out very small. They would have been a quarter of an inch when they were when they first emerged from the egg, and they grow very fast. It only takes a couple of weeks for them to reach the full-grown size, and at that point, they do a lot of wandering. It's not like they're just going to stay right there and make a chrysalis where they have been feeding. So could be any of the above, and this is another thing we're learning about monarchs that we didn't know before.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa with me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. You can join us at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and ISU Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. They're here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And next up, Mackie's on the line in Stone City. Hi, Mackie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your question?
Well, I've got a couple cedar trees, and I wonder if they're causing cedar rust on my peonies.
No. It could be some type of leaf spot, but your cedar basically is associated with, like, cedar apple rust and apples and crab apples, cedar hawthorn rust on hawthorns, and also cedar quince rust on hawthorns. But as far as the peonies, no. It's probably some type of other leaf spot.
Which has been very abundant,
very common this year.
This year because of the rain early on.
Mm-hmm. So with that, the best thing to do on that is when you cut them back later on, like in late October, early November, cut them off at the ground, that foliage, and remove that debris from the garden and destroy it. That's the best way to control it, sanitation.
Okay. Okay, that I do have an apple tree close to a cedar tree also.
Right.
And I sprayed it with some... you know, kind of an all-purpose, and it seemed to help. I only made one application of it, and it seemed to happen, or seemed to help in the springtime, but now on my, all the apples fell off at a certain point before they matured, and
well,
they turned kind of mealy.
Right. That may have been more to deal with insects than cedar apple rust. Cedar apple rust usually affects the actual foliage more than the fruit, and typically what you see on the foliage are these yellow spots with kind of a red margin to them. And if you check the underside of the foliage, those spots have little hairs that come out. And that's very, very common on certain apples and crab apples. The nice thing is with cedar apple rust, certain apples and certain crab apples are resistant to the disease. And that's the best way to avoid it.
All right, Mackie, thanks a lot for your call. Next, let's go to Janet in Dubuque. Hi, Janet.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a hardy hibiscus, which I planted on the northeast side of the house, which I think was a mistake because it's not growing very well. It did come up, but it's real late. It's only about 14 inches tall. I'd like to move it to another part of the yard, and I'm wondering, do I wait till it cools down, or shall I do it now, or do I wait till spring?
I would wait till spring. And they're kind of late in emerging in the spring, but as soon as they start to emerge from the ground as far as new growth, that's the time to dig it up and transplant it.
Okay. And is Southwest good? I have one there now, and it's flourishing.
Yeah, they typically like a nice, sunny location, so a south or southwest location would be ideal.
And any fertilizer once I transplant it?
No, I wouldn't worry about that. Just make sure it's well-watered for the first weeks after that.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Janet. Next, Tim in Des Moines. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I've got some peony seeds from China, and I was wondering how you go about planting them.
It's very, very difficult because the seeds, they germinate very sporadically. It may be 2 years or more before they germinate as far as peony seeds. That's why they're not grown from seeds very often. So it's hard to do. I guess if you want to try, what I would do is get a flat and some potting soil and plant the seeds in your potting soil. And once they've been planted, go ahead and moisten the potting soil. Use like a pot or a flat. And once they're watered, then I would put the flat or the pot in a plastic bag, and then I would place it in the refrigerator for probably 3 or 4 months. Then I would take it out, leave it at room temperature for maybe 2 or 3 months. If you don't see any germination, put them back in the refrigerator again for 2 or 3 months and keep on doing this until maybe you get some seeds. But it can be very difficult to germinate peony seeds, so it can be very frustrating.
All right, and if he's going to go through this whole process, and these are peony seeds from mm-hmm. China, does he need to do anything to make sure they can actually grow here?
Well, I'm assuming they would, but getting them to germinate probably is going to be the biggest obstacle.
All right, so it could be worth it if you get it to happen.
But it can be frustrating, and it may be 2 years, maybe 3 years in the future.
All right.
Andy might have better luck starting with a pineapple.
Probably.
Right. Good luck, Tim. Thanks a lot for your call. Ralph is on the line next in Grinnell. Hi, Ralph.
It's kind of a Bass Ackwards question. What's the best way to slow down already picked pears? Keep them in a cool basement or something?
Well, if you have picked pears and they're mature but not ripe, the best way to store them is to store them at a temperature just above freezing, like 34, 35 degrees, like in the refrigerator. That's the best place to put them, where they're nice and cool, because at those temperatures, it slows the processes occurring within that pear, because a pear is actually a living organism. And when it's very, very cold, everything slows down to almost a crawl.
All right. And pears should be just about ripe right now?
They should be, right.
How can you tell if they're ripe?
It can be hard. Basically, they're not ripe when you pick them. They're going to be mature when you pick them. They're still going to be hard as a rock. But if they're mature, if you pick them and then bring them inside, put them at room temperature, they'll typically ripen in a week or 10 days. As far as when to pick them, typically, there's a slight color change where they go from kind of a medium green to a light green. So if you're checking them periodically in late summer, you'll notice that change.
All right. I better get out there. Ralph, thanks a lot for your call. Here's an email from Gina. Is it too late to plant butterfly bushes? The monarchs seem to love them for nectar, and I don't seem to have a lot of luck keeping them for very many years. Is there a trick to planting them and keeping them alive?
Yeah, the butterfly bush is actually a woody plant. It typically dies back to the ground, usually in Iowa, because of our winters. I would be reluctant to plant it at this point because it really doesn't have much time to get reestablished before winter. And I would be concerned that it might winter kill completely if I plant it this late in the year. I would prefer much better spring.
All right. Here's a question from Mark. My son bought a house that had been empty for a while and has found a lot of big spiders outside the house and some inside. One group had about 20 spiders and some were as big as ping pong balls.
Wow.
What would you do to get rid of them?
I would buy a really good shop vac, a really good vacuum cleaner, and suck up all the ones inside, also suck up all of the webbing that may be associated, especially in the basement between the floor joists and so forth. The outdoor spiders are going to come and go. I don't think that has anything to do with that the house was empty. I think that's just a consequence of, okay, we moved in the fall and the spiders were already here. Indoor spider control, I think, is best done with a vacuum cleaner. So my advice is buy a good shop vac with the long extension tubes and the brush on the end so you can keep sweeping down spiders and their webs.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Sandy's on the line in Independence. Hi, Sandy.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I harrowed an apple tree, and we don't spray it. And I've been picking apples a few at a time and putting them in oatmeal. And there are greenish, brownish something on the skin, kind of with gold trails on it. I assume it's safe. I peeled some of it off. We ate some of it. I wondered what it was and if we should be doing something to prevent it or...
We were smiling in agreement up until you got to the part about the gold trails. Did you say this thing has a trail on it?
Well, it sort of looks like an etching a little bit.
Okay.
Although there's nothing in the meat that looks like anything's been walking around or whatever.
Yeah.
Growing.
There are some caterpillars that will scar the surface. That's what could have happened there. The greenish-brown stuff, I was wondering about sooty mold. With all the rain we've had, there's a fungus that grows on the surface of the fruit, and it will scrub off, but it's like taking grease off your fingers. You really have to scrub and rub hard. But that's a surface fungus that's not harmful.
And it's usually kind of a dark gray to black, so...
Yes.
It does look like soot, and that is very common on apples. On green varieties more so than on red, but with all the humidity this year as far as mid to late summer, those conditions are favorable for sooty mold on apples when you have a lot of humidity and moisture.
Mm-hmm.
The sooty mold itself is very disgusting to look at. It doesn't hurt the apples at all. You can actually eat them as they are as far as the skin with the sooty mold on them. It doesn't hurt you. But most people would actually probably peel them before they ate them.
Okay.
All right.
And is it true that when an apple has brown seeds that it's ripe?
Well, the best way to judge if an apple is ripe, in my mind, is as they approach maturity, typically they'll develop their characteristic color. And so when they approach maturity as far as that color, then I would pick an apple, maybe every 4 or 5 days, and taste it. To me, taste is the key as far as picking.
All right, Sandy, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Ann in Eldridge. Hi, Ann. Ann, are you there? Hi.
Yep, I'm here. Hi. I have a question about phlox. I planted a couple of phloxes 2 years ago, and one of them at the end of, a couple weeks ago, looks like a UFO landed right in the middle of it. And the heads were touching the ground, and when we went to try to fix it, prop it up, they just came loose from the ground. I don't know if they were, over too much water, or if they, I don't know. And I'm wondering if they're going to come back next year as they're perennials, or what'll happen.
Well, if it's garden phlox, I'm not concerned about it coming back next year. It should be fine. I don't know if something may be... landed on it or something of that nature that would cause it to bend over, maybe an animal or something of that nature.
Both of them are doing the same thing. The one that we pulled out was quite clearly rotten of some sort, but the other one has new sprouts coming up in the middle of it.
Okay.
It wants to live.
Well.
It does.
Okay. I'm not sure exactly what's going on. I would assume next year it would come back. They're very tough, resilient plants. So maybe just too much rain possibly this year.
Like our sedum autumn joy this year, worse than ever. They've just flopped to the ground because of the wet flower heads and the weight of the stems. Just with all the rain we've had, they've opened up more than usual.
But that's characteristic for the sedum. They tend to get very tall and very, very heavy, and they kind of flop over. But that usually doesn't happen with a phlox. So maybe all the moisture maybe is a factor in it.
Or maybe a UFO?
Possibly.
Maybe.
Or a deer or a rabbit.
All right, Ann, thanks a lot for your call. Next, we'll go to Nathan in Iowa City. Hi, Nathan.
Hello. Years ago, I was living in Michigan and going to Michigan State, and for a chemistry class, ended up writing a paper on the neem tree, N-E-E-M. And I was wondering what the odds are of being able to actually grow one of those here in Iowa.
Oh, the neem tree or the azadirachtin is native to India? I don't think we're quite the same climate.
Unless you have a greenhouse, I would say probably zero.
Okay, that's kind of what I was figuring, but I figured I could either continue on in ignorance or I could call and ask.
Okay. All right. Nathan, thanks a lot for your call.
Thanks a lot.
Yep. We all learned something today. I'd never even heard of a neem tree. So here's a question from Laura in Iowa City. I lost a pot of basil due to downy mildew. Is there any way of preventing this next year?
Boy, I don't know of a good way. Just making sure that you buy good quality plants, make sure they have a very favorable location, and hope for the best.
All right. And should she change locations or does that...
I don't think that makes much difference. I think I would just for rotation's sake, but I think it's mainly the weather.
All right. Bob is on the line next in Burlington. Hi, Bob. Oh, my fault. Sorry about that, Bob. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Mine's a spider question.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's a logistical one, I guess. I have two trees that are approximately 6 or 7, and none of their branches touch. There's just an open air space between them.
Uh-huh.
And every I get a large spider and spider web spanning the distance between the two trees.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the spider connect the web to these two trees that are 6 feet apart? Does it crawl on the ground, dragging a strand behind it, and then climb up the next tree, or what?
I think it's more likely magic, but yes, between the rows of the stalks of corn, between trees, between grasses growing along the road, you'll see that they have spanned this open space. Two possibilities. One is, yes, they might crawl across the ground pulling a drag line behind them. The other is they release a very small thread into the air that floats on the breeze, and when that sticky thread reaches somewhere else, it will latch on and be the first one, and then the first thing the spider does is go back and forth across this fragile throw line that it released out into space. It'll go back and forth and reinforce that, make it quite sturdy, make it put down line after line along the same route, and then begin to build the web in between. But I guess I'm going to have to stay up at night sometime or be up very early in the morning to watch this happen, because it does just seem like magic that they can build these webs almost in the middle of empty space. But this flying line that floats on the breeze because it's so light and thin, gossamer is what we call it, that appears to be the way most of them establish the first connection between trees.
All right, Bob, thank you so much. I'm sure that's a question many of us have stood and pondered, especially in those early morning hours looking at those spider webs.
How did she do that?
Mm-hmm. And now we know to say she. Thanks for correcting us on that one today,
oh, well,
Donald.
That's what I do.
All right, we are out of time for the day, but Donald Lewis, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Richard Giron, thank you for being here today.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. And we're actually going to be taking next Friday off from Horticulture Day. Next week is Iowa Week on Talk of Iowa and River to River. All week long, we'll be exploring different aspects of Iowa then and now. When we get started on Monday, we're going to take an in-depth look on River to River in jobs in Iowa then and now. And then on Talk of Iowa on Monday, we're going to talk about education. It should be a lot of fun all week long. We hope you'll join us. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.